And we'll say, I'm gonna sing out. I'm gonna march on. And everybody said,
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on.
I'm gonna march on.
Gonna put one foot in front of the other foot.
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on. Got to keep on going.
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on.
I'm gonna march on.
When my grandmama marched.
Hi there. I'm Jeff Browning, and welcome to Benders of the Arc podcast, where we interview movers and shakers for social change.
Most of us don't realize that young men, when they turn 18 years of age, are still required by law to register for the draft. This law only applies to young men. Women are exempt from this requirement. But the fact that young men in our country must still register for the draft feels like an anachronism from the Vietnam era. In reality, the requirement to register for the draft was reinstated by President Carter when Russia invaded Afghanistan in 1980. It also would seem to be an anachronism because we have been operating with an all-volunteer military for the last several decades. Nevertheless, this is the law which presents us also with an opportunity. One of the challenges of our modern media culture is that the use of violence and war are everywhere around us, in the form of television and movies, video games, news images from the streets of our cities, and of course, the all-too-real images of war from the front lines in Ukraine, Sudan, Yemen, and elsewhere. Very few of us have asked ourselves what we believe about the use of violence in war. If we don't take time to ask those questions, we will most likely adopt the values of our very pro-violence culture. That is why I wanted to talk with three very unique young adults about their decision to declare themselves to be conscientious objectors to war through the Presbyterian Church's program for recognizing conscientious objectors. Without a doubt, I have found this conversation with these three young adults to be one of the most inspiring conversations I have had in a long time. I hope you also find it inspiring. My three guests today are Chris Iyer, Joshua Ching, and Abby Pugh. Chris is an investigator in death penalty defense with the Habeas Corpus Resource Center in San Francisco. Chris is also a cognitive neuroscience researcher and a trumpet player. He is motivated to both deepen our appreciation of the human mind and enact those human-centered values in our social systems. Chris is 22 years old. Joshua's life is centered around learning foreign languages and traveling. He has a lot of connections with friends abroad, especially in Asia. Last year, he taught English in Taiwan and traveled throughout South Korea. He has also studied abroad in Japan in middle school and high school. While he was teaching in Taiwan, warplanes were constantly flying over their schools and city, and the planes were so loud that it interrupted his teaching. He does some drone building, and he is interested in drone racing. The drone racing community has some affiliations with the military. They often sponsor these drone racing events. Joshua is 21 years old. Abigail Pugh is a recent grad from Scripps College, where she studied Asian American studies and politics. In the past, they've been involved in nonprofit work, student organizing, and local city council candidate campaigns. In the fall, she's looking forward to teaching Filipino-American studies in San Francisco schools with the organization Panay Educational Partnerships. In her free time, she enjoys drinking coffee, playing soccer, and knitting sweaters for her family and friends. Abby is 22 years old.
Thank you, all three of you, for joining us today. Abby, as the only young woman among us, would you care to, and young men, only young men are required to register for the draft. So I'm curious, what led you to participate in this as a young woman?
I think, so when I declared as a CO, I was 18 and now I'm 22. And I think kind of what led me to be drawn to this process is the way that becoming a CO was kind of a declaration of values. Like, of course, it's the actual objective of like being able to abstain from military service. But also for me, it was a way to kind of state my beliefs in relation to the military and to militarism. And kind of the connection of that to other things I was exploring at that time in terms of my own identity. So also like thinking about where I've kind of come from since like declaring SEO in terms of like thinking about gender and like what that means and the way that the military also dictates this kind of like very binary gender identity marking of like male and female. And thinking about like what that means to me as well. But yeah, so I was initially drawn to it just because I think that the values that come along with CO status really aligned with what I believed in. And so it was less so of, I think, a like genuine fear. I think that was also, it was part of it, like a genuine fear of like the military, of the draft and all those things. But also it was a way for me to make like a very like, to me, profound statement of what I believed in, especially in terms of like that political context at the time. For me, it was, I believe, January of 2020. So, yeah.
Great. Thank you. Josh, would you care to share anything about what inspired you to participate in that process?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it was a lot of different things. First and foremost, I guess sort of my age, you know, when guys become 18, they have to sign up for the draft. So I think it's something that it's good to think about. But I think that I was kind of exposed to a lot of war related things from a younger age, since maybe around the time of like 9 years old, I started playing a lot of like violent video games and things like that. And so I was always kind of had a lot of things in my life that had to do with that sort of thing. And I think that a big part of it for me was when my grandmother passed away. That was the first time I'd ever had anyone like in my life who was like close to me pass away. And I just kind of realized how significant that can be. And I made me look at the sort of games where you're killing lots of people and stuff in a different line. I kind of realized like, wait, this, something's not right here, you know? And so as I was coming to the age of 18 where I'd have to sign up for the draft, I thought it was really important to kind of think more about how I think about war and death and all that. And so I thought it was important to sort of declare sort of my beliefs as well, kind of like Abby was saying.
Thank you. Chris, what tell us a little bit about what inspired you.
Yeah, first of all, thank y'all for those answers. That was, I definitely reiterate a lot of the same themes that you guys just brought up. I would add that I think like when I was, I can't even remember how old I was. You have a very good memory, but it was somewhere in the teens. And that experience comes of being faced with the prospect of being drafted into the military. At the time, it felt like there's probably no chance that this would ever happen. And with the hindsight of the past 4 to 8 years or whatever, there was a chance that it could have happened. And I guess there continues to be as the world continues to evolve. But one of the things that was really important for me was the community that I was in, the family that I grew up in, the church that I, you know, undertook this as a part of, didn't match the values that that were assumed when you turn 18 of to be patriotic is to fight for your country if necessary. And I think being able to, yeah, like Abby said, make that statement of values, like Josh said, be able to sort of put your foot down in a culture that's kind of awash with violence. It meant a lot to me to be able to do that. And looking back, I'm really glad I did it because it could have happened that I could have been in the military, and it still could. And that's a valuable and a pretty rare thing, I think, to have done.
Mm-hmm. We seem to have lost Abby here. I hope she'll join us, join back in. But so what was the process like for you? Was it fairly easy? Was it, was there a kind of iterative process of conversations that you went through? You know, reading your statements, they're so eloquent. Almost prophetic, I guess, that I find them very inspiring. So I'm wondering what that process was like for you.
Josh, you want to start?
Yeah, sure. So do you mean the process of actually like filing for the conscientious objection, or like just kind of like thinking about it myself and coming to the decision to make?
More about thinking about it yourself and
Yeah. I think that, a lot of it sort of had to do with kind of realizing how precious life is and all of that. And just the thought of having to take another person's life kind of, you know, made me really nauseous inside. And I just realized that, you know, this is not something that I would ever be able to do or would be all right with. Mm-hmm. And so it got me starting to think more about war as a whole. I started watching movies about war and going into like the lives of the soldiers and things like that. I think a good one was, I believe it's called like Hacksaw Ridge. It's about a medic in the military and all that, and just seeing the horrors of war and just being like, this is, yeah, kind of like Chris was saying, it's just not a part of my values. This doesn't seem right to me. And so I started thinking about that more. One thing that I think also helped is I read a book called War is a Lie by David Swanson. And I feel like that kind of helped sort of debunk a lot of beliefs that I had, or that like is the general public opinion about war and how it's, you know, for defense and all of that. And it kind of just made me realize that, yeah, I don't think that I can really agree with this. And so that was sort of what led me to the decision. And my family's been a part of the Presbyterian Church ever since I was born, basically. And so we had a strong connection there, and there are resources there that kind of helped me out come to this decision as well. So,
mm-hmm. Right. Chris?
Yeah, I would add upon that I can remember a pretty similar moment where maybe the first time as part of this process of being prompted to think about this stuff, I actually pictured what it would be like to be holding a gun to point at somebody and to have to shoot. And that to me was a pretty impactful moment in terms of, I think war is an abstract thing. It's for defense. It's done by soldiers, and there are casualties, and it's sort of filled with as many euphemisms as you can stuff into it. But part of this process was beginning to actually think about how these things work. I would emphasize that in my case, a lot of that was done and made possible by the kind of community. I think that I didn't have a ton, and I still don't have lots of real world experience with what it means to be in a war, to be in a country that is a war zone. And a lot of this was enabled and cultivated within me by my mentors in the church, by my family, who sort of asked me the right questions. You know, would you be able to do this? Do you think that if your country's military asked you to do something violent, could you do it? These are questions that don't come up in sort of day-to-day life, and being able to take that on community. There was definitely an iterative process. You know, I was reading over that final version of the CO statement, and I can remember previous iterations, maybe less prophetic, and they got more prophetic along the way. But it was definitely sort of, yeah, a process of beginning to take all these, you know, moral learnings that I had acquired up until the time and actually put them to use for maybe the first time, and begin to develop my own ideas on the topic, apart from, you know, so maybe one of the first times that I expressed values apart from my like school peers. That's sort of like, maybe not one of the first times, but an important time for me. So I think being able to do that in community, and also being able to, spend a few months just sort of learning and deepening my appreciation analysis of the issues at hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Abby, while you were away, I was asking how, what the process was like, and how it was, how they went through the process for preparing their statement. And do you care to add anything to that?
So I think for me, my dad is a Presbyterian minister, and so he was pastoring First Press in Palo Alto, and came to me with this opportunity, or like the process. I had never heard of it before, but again, like at this, like at that, like political moment, there was like a lot of kind of turmoil over like the draft and the possibility of a draft, and so then I kind of went through the process. And I think in terms of like the writing of my statement, it was kind of difficult for me to actually put into words the beliefs that I had kind of been raised in, and that led me to like want to go through the process. And I think it was one of the first times where I really had to vocalize my beliefs in that way, and vocalize them in a way that like vocalize them into an act, kind of like what you all were saying. So yeah, I think it was, again, like what you all were saying, it was kind of the product of like the values that I had been raised with that led me to like actually be able to take this stance and go through the process.
I would add one more thing, sorry, Jeff, which is one of the things I learned early on in the process, and I remember it was either you or Craig Wiesner who let us know this, which is that, and I don't know if this is still the case, but on the draft form, I expected there to be a little conscientious objector box. And I think, well, at this point, all of us are familiar with the process of having to write the thing across the top of the paper, because there's not even, this isn't even considered an option by whoever is making this form. And I think that kind of encapsulates, you know, up until age 16 or whenever I was doing this, I probably had just filled out forms straight up. I wasn't really doing small acts of rebellion in the way I was filling out forms like that. And that's sort of like a powerful maybe encapsulation of what the whole process meant.
It's they don't want to make it easy for you.
No, they don't.
But I guess I'm, you know, what I hear you saying is that the process of writing a statement really helped you to clarify your values and your thinking about this. And it occurs to me, maybe we should require all adults as part of their process, membership in the church or whatever, to write down, what do you actually believe about the use of violence in war? So Abby, I'm curious if your studies in gender studies, if that clarified anything for you. Is there anything in your studies that either strengthened or sacrificed your kind of beliefs, or strengthened your beliefs about conscientious objection and the use of war and violence?
Yeah, for sure. I think when I went into college, I had decided I was going to study politics. And like, I was very lucky that the political department at my school was very like abolition centered and social justice focused. But I think that where I learned the most and the part of my studies that had the most connection to CO status was definitely my Asian American studies courses. I think ethnic studies as a discipline really is extremely like anti-imperial, anti-militarism. That's like at the core of ethnic studies values. And I also think part of ethnic studies is not only the academics, but also the practice. And I think that CO is a way of kind of practicing what you preach. So I think that there's lots of connections between this and a lot of the things that I learned in my ethnic studies courses in terms of connecting like the things like the draft and militarism to larger systems of like imperialism, colonialism, white supremacy. And I think that a lot of my studies helped me to kind of draw those connections and also like drawing connections from my daily life to like those larger systems of oppression and seeing like ways that we can fight back and kind of like what Chris was saying in terms of like daily acts of rebellion and things that we can do to fight back against those systems, which I think CO is like a way of doing that.
Yeah. Josh, was there anything in your studies that you have found supportive or have even undermined your views about war and conscientious objection?
In my studies, I don't think I've had too much relating to war. It's mostly, you know, math and coding. But I would say that definitely outside of school, a lot of my extracurricular activities seem to be very like internationally focused or just happen to have, you know, relationships with war, like, for example, like with drone building and racing. It's just a fun hobby. It's like, you know, working on a race car or something like that, except for it can fly. And I think that's really cool. But unfortunately, at a lot of events relating to this sort of thing, there's a lot of sort of military relation that they're looking for, like, you know, drone pilots and things like that, right? Mm-hmm. And so I feel like, well, maybe not directly in my like school education, in my extracurricular activities and stuff, I've had to encounter, you know, like a lot of like military like recruiters and things like that. And that's been interesting, but I would say not too much in my formal education.
So are they actually using those events as recruitment events?
They aren't explicitly recruitment events. It's more like they're racing events that are sponsored when one of their sponsors happens to be, you know, the Air Force, right?
Uh-huh. So they have a recruitment.
So they'll have like a recruitment booth. Yeah. They'll have a booth or they'll have someone there, you know, giving out free stickers or something and saying like, oh, would you be interested in, you know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Usually you don't have to engage with them if you don't want to, which is good, but they do usually have some kind of representation at a lot of events.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Chris, how about you? Have you found anything in your studies or maybe you want to tell us about your work? I don't know if that's paid work or not, but your work with the Habeas Corpus Resource Center.
Sure. Yeah, I absolutely feel that some of the stuff I studied in school, one of my fields of study was human rights, and I also studied cognitive science. But yeah, I work now with it's an office called the Habeas Corpus Resource Center. We do death penalty defense, and within it, it's part of the appeals process. And within that, we're doing something called mitigation, which is the phase of a trial where you're able to bring any evidence of somebody's life, any aspect of someone's life story that might be able to mitigate a jury's desire to sentence that person to death.
Is this prior to conviction or after conviction?
This is post-conviction. So we're working with folks, many of whom have been in prisons for decades now, many of whom have pretty hard childhood histories of hard families that they grew up in, hard institutions that they were placed in from young ages. And I would say that the same the same sort of impetus that drove me to conscientious objection has brought me to this job. I feel that I work in pretty close proximity to violence, to folks who have committed serious violence. And this field and the work has demanded me and my colleagues to find ways to wrestle with that. What does it mean to bring out the humanity of somebody who has committed such serious violence? What does it mean to find ways for them to be accountable in ways that the quote unquote justice system does not offer? I think of that kind of violence. This is interpersonal. This is acts of violence from one person to another as continuous with the same logics of war that bring one nation into violence against another. Anyways, at the risk of rambling on, I would say that I see this job as a continuation of the same values, and I see work for peace as unfolding across those different levels.
Mm-hmm. Well,
let's take a break. And when we come back, I'll ask our guests about their reading of history and whether or not that influenced their decision to become conscientious objectors. Stay with us.
And we'll say, I'm gonna sing out. I'm gonna march on. And everybody said,
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on.
If you are new to our podcast, please visit our blog at bendersoftheark.com, where you can find more information about our stories and the people behind them. Now let's return to our guest.
I'm wondering if you have any reading of U.S. history that has influenced you in either pro-conscientious objection or against that. Is there any views on U.S. history that is affecting your views?
I can go. I would say that I'm not, I don't think of myself as being an expert about U.S. history, but in the books that I've read, I did read something interesting in the book that I mentioned earlier, War is a Lie, about how, a lot of wars are sort of supposed to be like in self-defense, right? But I thought an interesting example that they gave was with Pearl Harbor. And how they mentioned that there were, the U.S. government was actually had some pretty good information that there was a good chance that it could get attacked. And there are like records of higher up government officials talking about how they were actually sort of hoping that we would be attacked so that we would have an excuse to get into the war and things like that. And so I thought it was interesting how, things might not always be as clean cut as they seem, and that, oh, we were attacked first, we need to defend ourselves and things like that, when in reality, even before that happened, we had been wanting some kind of an excuse to get into the war, since unfortunately America is a country that makes quite a lot of profits from the war effort.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Abby, would you care to contribute anything?
Sure. Yeah. I think almost any reading of like authentic American history will tell you that war has been used throughout like so-called like America's history as like a project of like white supremacy, patriarchy. Like, it's been used historically to uphold all of these systems of oppression and to keep like specific groups of people in positions of power. And I think that learning about American history, or like learning about like the project of American history, is really what kind of brought me to this in the first place. Kind of just like the ability to like kind of learn about how like my own family has been impacted by like American wars, and the ways that those wars have also been the narratives of those wars have been very specifically taught in schools so as to kind of benefit the narrative of like American exceptionalism, American defense, all of these things that I had kind of internalized previous to some of the like courses of American history that I had taken in like high school and in college, and the ways that those narratives and like propaganda around war has kind of led to like false ideas around what American war is, like very intentionally so. So I think that for me, like learning about American history really made me think like it's not so like cut and dry. Like it's not war is good, war is American defense. Like it's very clear that America has used war as like a tool of imperialism, of like cis heteropatriarchy, in order to uphold very specific hierarchies that benefit like a select few folks. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Chris, do you wanna?
Yeah. I'll hop in here as well. Yes, totally echo what both of you said. Pearl Harbor was the example that I was thinking of because I was at the Pearl Harbor Museum recently. And I think they did a good job of presenting Pearl Harbor not as a as an isolated incident of like, you know, who could have expected this horrible tragedy to happen, and it was a tragedy, many lives were lost, but also thinking about it situated in the kind of like global order that the US has created. Why was it necessary why did Japan feel it necessary to do something like that to the US? What kind of implications, what kind of consequences did that have in the US internment policies? And we all know the sort of dark ending of US-Japan portion of World War II. So anyways, I appreciate you bringing that up. The one idea I would also add in reference to US history is that I think there have definitely, as I've sort of learned more about US history, there have definitely also instances that have pushed me on my nonviolence. I think of Nat Turner and the legacies of the rebellion of enslaved people, and I think of the Black Panthers, and you know, 2 years ago when there was a sort of a flurry of public discourse about what it means to loot and burn a building. These are instances that I would not say have totally transformed my core conviction against violence, but I think they're important things to think about. They're important things to wrestle with, is in the context of violent regimes and in the context of war, what sorts of rebellion are necessary for struggles for a better world. So I'd also add that that's an aspect of US history to also bring to this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If I could just add on really quickly to Chris's point, I think first off, I would offer the reading of How Nonviolence Protects the State by Peter Gelderloos. I read that recently and it kind of like really, again, like made me think about nonviolence. I think like at my core, I do really like hold nonviolence near and dear to my heart. And like that is at the core of my values. But again, like looking at the way that throughout history, like the American government and like the same folks who are deciding whether or not we go to war have really villainized certain figures in history and certain movements in history as violent and therefore bad, while like state violence, like going to war, has been characterized as good and for the good of the people. And so just thinking about like why that is and why the state gets to deem certain people as bad because of violence and certain violence as good. So like just wanted to add that to the conversation as well.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. Thank you. These are important questions and perspectives that we need to keep the conversation going. It's not like we achieve some sort of nirvana of nonviolence or being conscientious objectors, and suddenly we stop asking questions or stop the conversation. But I think this is a. I think part of my frustration is that we're not having enough conversations about these things. So much of the time in churches and in our culture, it's just assumed that the perspective, the military perspective, takes priority and is is given a place of valor as over opposed to those that are trying to prevent violence in some way. And I think stand up for justice, you know, this seems to be a very important part of this. It's not just that we're pacifists as though we're doing nothing. So how do, I guess that's one question that comes up is, how would you respond to those that say that being pacifist or being even a CO is too idealistic in this world, and that we have no business doing that? Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I have a couple thoughts. The first is, you know, in a way, that's right. I would never say that there's no truth there. I'm under no illusions that the small number of COs is not going to, you know, take away from the strength of the American military in terms of people power and in terms of technological power. And I think the idealism of being a CO is its strength, that we do live in a pretty militarized country, arguably one of the most. And being a CO doesn't change that, but it's about, I think, like you said, it's about finding ways to be courageous without being violent. And it's about finding ways to work for justice without being violent. You know, a good example to my mind comes from the distinction between nonviolence and nonviolent direct action that MLK emphasized time and time again. I think that nonviolence is not about doing nothing. Doing nothing is maybe idealistic in a different way. But anyways, all this is to say, it's true. It is idealistic in a sense because of the context in which we're all sitting. And also, that's the strength of it, to imagine a better or more peaceful world through that statement of values.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that I would add that, yeah, like Chris was saying, a lot of it is about kind of showing your support for this idealistic version of society, and to show that, hey, this is what we want to try to strive to, and this is, we're showing our support by being a part of this. I think it also encourages people to consider other viewpoints, because if they've never met anyone who's been a conscientious objector before, they might not even know that's an option, right? A lot of people, I feel like, is just, you know, there's one road and that's all there is. So I think that being a part of something like being a conscientious objector, you're helping to kind of give other people other perspectives about war and things like that. And in terms of, you know, different wars being for, you know, self-defense and whatnot, I think that, you know, it also helps people sort of think critically about wars, at least, that maybe, you know, some wars may, you know, require different sorts of action, but at least it encourages people to think more about, you know, does this war really make that much sense? Or what is the point of this? Why is this happening? And who's, you know, gaining from this, right? So even if it's hard to give a blanket statement that all wars are this or all wars are that, or all violence is this, all violence is that, I think that it's at least kind of showing our support and being out there helps kind of our society be more critical in the way we think about these topics.
Yeah, I would just echo what y'all have been saying. And I think, again, like, for me, it's less so like the idea that becoming a CEO is going to have this like massive impact, and more of a way for me to do something with my values and my beliefs, like to act in a way. And so it's kind of like the idea of like recycling a plastic water bottle is not going to solve the climate crisis, but you do it because like that's what your morals align with. And so for me, like, my morals align with CEO. And so I think, yeah.
So I guess a part of that might be to ask the question, is there a part of this that matches your spiritual values? What effect does being a CO have on your spiritual life in whatever way that you perceive that. Not necessarily whether or not you strongly adhere to our Christian values, but however you interpret your own spiritual values, what impact does this have?
I can speak a little bit on this. I think, like, having been raised in the church, I was always taught to understand and to feel God as a loving figure, and like as a nonviolent figure. And so I think that very, like, for me, it was very clear, like, how both, like, my spirituality and CO status were connected. And just kind of saying CO is kind of like a continuation of, like, my idea of my spirituality and of God and, like, of, like, the community that I had grown up with. Particularly just, like not only seeing God as a loving figure, but also seeing church as a place where we build community and take care of each other. And again, like, CO fits right into that, like, the beliefs and the values that are tied to being CO in terms of, like, taking care of each other and standing up for what I believe in. So yeah, they're very tied together for me.
Josh or Chris, would you care to?
Yeah, I can chime in. So I would say that I am not, really strongly religious, but I do believe that life is really sacred and that we should try to be kind to each other. I think that sort of, even just looking at it from, like, a scientific perspective, like, the chances that we're all here on this earth is so, 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 so incredibly small that I think that it makes no sense to be spending this precious time we have on earth and, you know, this life that we've been given and use it to inflict pain on others and to take that gift away from others. So I think regardless of religion and things like that, I feel like just it doesn't make sense to, be violent and to take life away from others, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that for me, this kind of relationship goes both ways. I absolutely think of one of the core aspects of my faith is the beauty and the value of all of creation. And that can be expressed, I think, in Christian terms with, you know, the concept that, we're lucky to have been created and that God loves us for who we are and that we don't have to kind of, and like I said, it can also go the other direction, but I think one of the ways that I realize what faith is and develop my own faith is seeing it as something that can interact with the real world. And the CO process was one of those that religion and faith and spirituality does exist kind of internally in the heart, but it also exists in the world. I think that's especially important to make clear and make vocal in a culture where Christianity is often conflated with one conception of Christianity that lives on with a very different set of values than I would say my Christian upbringing maintains. So I would say that relationship goes both ways for me. These are expressions of the same sort of gratefulness for life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. I sometimes think of my commitment to being a conscientious objector or pacifism as a kind of spiritual discipline, where I don't, I'm kind of trying to struggle to find my way around this. It's sort of like all of those other virtues that we think of, with love and peace and kindness and all of those sorts of abstract virtues. But this is something that is sort of grounded in the world. How do I do this as a spiritual discipline? And it's almost irrespective of what I believe about you know, am I orthodox? Am I heterodox? Am I a heretic? But sort of grounding it in the day to day of, okay, how do I live nonviolently? How do I live in compassion and empathy with the world around me? Suddenly kind of grounds my faith and my perspective in how I live my life.
I love that. I just want to jump in. I love that perspective too, Jeff, because I think that conscientious objecting is framed as a kind of negative thing of like, you're assumed to be able to inflict violence unless you opt out. And framing it that way is a challenge to us to say, okay, this is going to be hard. Like, go do nonviolence in your life. What does that mean for, you know, military violence? But also, what does it mean when you get into a fight with your friend? I really believe. And what does it mean? Yeah, when you're sort of in your own mind and in your own kind of world, what does it mean to live those values? I appreciate that point.
Let's take another break, and when we return, I'll ask our guests to read from their statements about conscientious objection. Stay with us.
And we'll say, I'm gonna sing out. I'm gonna march on. And everybody said,
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on.
I'm gonna march on.
If you are new to our podcast, please visit our blog at bendersoftheark.com, where you can find more information about our stories and the people behind them. Now let's return to our guest.
I was wondering, Joshua, if you would be willing to read that first paragraph in your statement.
Yeah, sure. Okay. So, all right. Death and destruction, those are the calling cards of war. It takes and takes and takes and leaves nothing but carnage in its wake. Cities, hospitals, schools, and everything in between become rubble, covered in the smoldering corpses of what used to be people. I believe that war is horribly evil, and I can't stomach the thought of taking any part in the slaughter of my fellow human beings.
Thank you. Do you have any other thoughts about that? Is there anything else that you would like to... it sounds like this... one book particularly inspired you.
Yeah, so, it did. Yeah. I feel like with that opening paragraph, it was sort of like I was maybe letting out some of my frustrations about how gruesome the reality of war is and how it's always so sugar-coated whenever we see it in media. But when you hear stories from people who've actually been there, who've had to actually do horrific things, it's far from pretty. And so I kind of wanted to just kind of convey what it really means for war to exist and for countries to go to war. It's not just, oh, let's find out who wins. There's so much more than just that. And so I guess I tried to not go too much into detail, but also at the same time, I wanted to try to convey that these are real people. These are real places. This is people's houses, just like where me and you are talking from right now, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that. Abby, would you be willing to read a portion of yours?
Sure, yeah. I'm trying to think, like, some of mine, I'm like, I don't know. I wrote this 4 years ago, so I don't know if I believe in that anymore. But let me see. I can maybe go to Chris, and then when you come back to me, I'll have my piece figured out.
Okay, I really liked the last paragraph. I thought the last paragraph of your statement was very powerful, but we can go to Chris here. Chris, I was wondering if you would read the first paragraph on the second page.
Yes. I wondered why kids around me didn't talk about or even seem to think about nonviolence. I realize it's because the world gives us plenty of chances to ignore our conscience. We can say the Pledge of Allegiance in class every day without questioning why patriotism comes before morality. We can see commercials for the military on TV and take it for granted that violence and war are necessary parts of patriotism. We can be carried by our own inertia from childhood first-person shooter video games into a very real battlefield, pointing a very real rifle at the human heart. Our conscience can become a feeble murmur against the droning voice of violence. What? That's an idea. I think something like what Josh was talking about earlier of the kind of, in many ways, this is the water that we're in is, especially, I think, yeah, growing up in a culture of, all the examples I brought up, the conflation of patriotism with militarism, the kind of video games and media that wash over us time and time again, as I was growing up. These are ways of conditioning people. It's maybe no surprise that the Department of Defense is funding some of these very same video games because they think, and they maybe rightly think, that these attitudes are related. And I think breaking from that, that drone, as I put it, was a really important part of the CO process for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. Happy?
Yeah. I think I'm going to read the first paragraph of mine. I do not believe in the use of war and violence by the United States for and in any circumstance. I believe in the use of peace, support, and anti-violence work. I believe that war and violence rarely lead to any positive impact and are rarely inspired and or led by someone who has a positive impact in mind. Having studied American states history, United States history, I feel informed enough about the history of war in America to feel confident in saying that I do not support war under any circumstances, especially in how America wages war. The people in government who decide to use war and violence as a representation of American position have rarely represented my own beliefs, perspectives, and experiences. Additionally, as a young woman of color, I feel strongly opposed to supporting a war effort instituted by a government which has profited off the institutional use of racism and sexism for its entire existence. Rather than create more upheaval, horror, and pain, I feel the government should first focus on the healing needed from its past wars and acts of violence.
Very powerful. Do you care to say any more about that?
I think that a lot of this still rings very true to me, and I think this was kind of a very raw, a lot of my kind of education around like American history happened like my senior year of high school, which would have been like this was right after I had graduated high school, or maybe 6 months after I graduated high school. And so a lot of this is kind of coming from that kind of period of realization of like, I've been lied to by the education system my whole life. And the kind of dissonance that I felt between like my experiences and my identities and what history was telling me I should feel in terms of war and violence. And so I was very grateful to have like the CO process as a way to kind of like vent those frustrations that I was feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Would you recommend this process to other young people, young adults?
I would definitely recommend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would say at the time that I was embarking on it, I embarked on it with several people who decided in the end not to become conscientious objectors. And I think what you said, Jeff, earlier is exactly right, that anybody of any type of faith and of any type of perspective on military involvement in their own life, I think it does good to think about this stuff. I think it does good to call a real image to mind about what it means to be in a war. And could you do that? And why could you do that if you could? So I absolutely recommend it to anyone.
Yeah. Well, is there anything else that you would like to share with us that you think that we haven't covered? Did I blank out again?
Oh, no, we can hear you. Yeah, okay. I would just urge people to really think about this if they get the chance, because it's one of those things I think a lot of people kind of see it as being something that happens in some far off country that you hear about in some news channel or something like that. But it can happen really suddenly, and you never know when it won't be the news channel that you'll be getting the information from, but from your friend or neighbor or something like that. Like sort of, you know, when I was in Taiwan and stuff, when I was originally doing the conscientious objector stuff, I'd never thought that I'd be directly in sort of a potential war zone. But when I was in Taiwan and teaching English, they had military planes flying overhead because of tensions with mainland China. And the planes were so like close to the ground, so loud, like I was worried that the windows were going to shatter. You couldn't even like hear yourself think or say anything. And, you know, here we are supposed to teach these kids about English. And it's like, I feel like, you know, it's good to realize that if you're in a situation normally like here in America where you don't have to worry about these things, there are places that are very, very real that are going through this stuff. And so you never know that when it could be at your home, right? And so I think it's important to think about this and give it some real consideration, regardless of, you know, what your personal situation is.
Any other thoughts?
Yeah, I would, through this conversation and looking back at my old CO statement, and I think one thing that I've realized has been really important for my development on this journey since then, and I think this speaks directly to what Josh was just saying as well, is make this stuff real for yourself, whatever that means. I think at the time, war and violence were in the abstract, and that sort of came through in my statement as thinking of violence as sort of an unconstrained moral choice. Like, how could anybody do this? Seek out folks who have been affected by this stuff. Seek out folks who have engaged in and maybe come around from types of violence that only existed in the abstract before. These are people, and these are places and people that have taught me much more than kind of the abstract conception of what war and violence is. And at the end of the day, that's a very important part of thinking about this, is taking into account the realities of what it is. And, you know, if when you hear the plane or when you talk with somebody who's been affected by this stuff, it takes on a new lens for sure.
I would just echo exactly what you all have said. I'm not going to repeat it because you all said it very well. But yeah.
Well, and I'm just wondering, Abby, if you have any thoughts. I mean, one of the things that I find myself getting upset about is kind of the ongoing explosion of sexual violence in the military, and the way that they keep saying that they are going to get it under control, and they haven't, and the numbers just keep increasing. And so it's hard for me to resist a comparison or a correlation between that and, you know, patriarchy and domination of men over women. And you've spoken to that a little before, but I was just wondering if you had any other thoughts about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, the military as an organization is inherently violent. It's almost its sole project is to enact violence on behalf of the United States. And the United States is founded on violence against women and against like other like against gender minorities. And so I think that's the reason why, like, despite what the military might be saying, like, it is based on that violence. It is founded on violence against, like, women, against gender minorities, in addition to, and in intersection with, you know, violence against people of color and, like, marginalized communities. And so I think the military is, like, a huge part of upholding patriarchy and cis-hetero patriarchy. And so it's kind of, yeah, it's the idea that the military is saying, like, oh, we're getting it under control, when it's inherently founded on those systems of violence, is just kind of like, it's really interesting to think about, because it benefits so much from violence against women. Yeah.
Any other thoughts that care to contribute?
I would also just say thanks, Jeff, for the opportunity to reread my statement and think about this stuff again and put myself back into mind space. It was a valuable experience. So I'm happy you put this together.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Jeff, for helping us to sort of figure this all out back then, and helping us to guide us then, and helping to bring it back into our lives again now. And so we can just continue to think about it and, you know, consider it as a part of ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm glad that I could do that then. And thank you so much for this conversation now. It's a real gift to reconnect with you. And thank you so much for your contributions to this conversation. All the best in your efforts going forward here. It just warms my heart to know that you are out there in the world living these values of love and nonviolence for all people. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
If you are interested in learning more about how to become a conscientious objector through the Presbyterian Church USA, please visit the Benders of the Ark blog at bendersoftheark.com or the Presbyterian Peace Fellowship website as presbypeacefellowship.org. You may also find the Inventory of Conscience survey to be a good way to begin your journey toward peace and justice. Thank you again for listening.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Benders of the Ark podcast, where we explore the stories of those who dare to do the hard work of social change and bending the arc of the Moore universe toward justice. Be sure to subscribe and check out more stories and interviews at bendersoftheark.com. Our music is a splendid creation of Joshua Campbell titled Sing Out, March On. So until next time, keep bending the arc of the Moore universe toward justice for creation and all of God's people.